the big takeaway for me from this story, find a watch that that other people like, that is popular, is important, is historical, that you don't connect with, and like go deep on it and like figure out why you might like it. And ultimately you might not, like ultimately you might not connect with it, but like I think that exercise is good, and it'll kind of like teach you about what you do and don't like from a more conceptual standpoint, instead of just saying like, I like this watch, I don't like that watch, I like this watch, I don't like that watch. You'll start to say, this is what I like about watches. Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. We have a super fun show for you this week. We've got three great segments, and to kick things off, we've got the results of the 2020 Summer Watch Fantasy Draft. If you haven't listened to Hodinkee Radio episode 93, I recommend you go back and check that out. Otherwise, this isn't going to make a whole lot of sense to you, but we brought Kara, James, and John back on the show, and we've also got our producer, Gray, on the mic. And Gray is going to tell us the results of our fantasy watch draft. We're going to count down from fourth place to first place. You guys voted and picked the winner. I had no idea heading into this who won, and you'll just have to wait and see. But in addition to announcing the winner, we also talk about which watches we wish we could have picked and which draft we might do next. After that, we're going to do a deep dive into Volume 6 of the Hodinkee magazine. First up, I've got Cole and Jack coming on to talk about the stories that they wrote for the issue. We've got Cole's profile of one of the world's most prolific Bang & Olufsen radio collectors, and we've got Jack's ode to a unique Aston Martin with a Bertone body and an absolutely insane backstory. And then I'll talk a little bit about the reference points that I put together about the Tag Heuer Carrera and what it taught me, not just about the Carrera, but what it taught me about watches in general. And to finish things up, I was able to get Ben into the virtual studio to talk about the profile that he wrote of the artist Wes Lang. Wes is a real diehard watch collector. He's somebody that doesn't play by anybody else's rules. He's not afraid to break the mold. And as you'll hear, there's a lot we can learn from him about watches and just about how to live our lives in maybe a more interesting way. Ben's got some great insights, as always, and I think you're really going to love it. So without further ado, let's do this. Hey, how you guys doing?
Doing well. How are you?
Good.
It's Friday. It's Friday in the Hodinkee-verse.
Friday what?
In the universe.
In the universe. Yeah, I guess. Okay. It's Friday outside the Hodinkee-verse as well, but...
Everywhere but Australia.
Yeah. Kara's gearing up for another Friday Live. I'm gearing up for a weekend. I think life's good.
Very good.
We've got our producer Gray here as well, in addition to John, Kara, and James. How's it feel to be on mic, Gray?
The terrifying lows and the dizzying heights of being on Hodinkee Radio once again. Thanks for having me.
All right. We're here to give you the results of the 2020 Summer Watch Fantasy Draft, which we did a couple weeks ago in episode 93. If you haven't listened to episode 93, go back and listen to it, or this segment isn't going to make a whole lot of sense. It was one of our fantasy draft episodes. The goal was to build a five watch summer watch collection. There were some rules about pricing and how we drafted. You can go read those. We'll link it up in the show notes. It'll make a lot more sense than me just kind of re-explaining it here. But before Gray reveals the results, which none of the four of us have seen, it's probably a good idea to just quickly go back through our collections. So, Kara, you want to maybe kick us off and just walk us through your five watches?
Sure. Okay, so my picks were the Rolex Subnodate, the Patek Nautilus Reference 7118A, the Zodiac Super Seawolf with the blue, the Freestyle Shark Watch, and the Apple Watch Series 5.
How do you feel about your collection there? How do you feel about your chances?
I feel really good about my chances.
Yeah?
I'm not going to lie. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm gonna mean I like I hope I lost because I was just so arrogant to say that I feel so good about my chance. But
all right, we'll see.
It's a good collection. I think it hits all the beats. You got the smartwatch, you got the casual watch, you got the fancy watch, you got the mid-range watch, and they all are, you can all kind of go in the pool with them. So I feel good about that.
All right. Let's we'll see how this plays out. James, you wanna go next? Tell us about your collection.
For sure. So I got an Audemars Piguet Royal Oak Offshore Diver. Blue and yellow is the spec. Nice blue rubber for summer. Next up, the Omega Seamaster Plo Prof, which I think is just doesn't require a lot of explanation. A hilarious watch that I really wish I actively had this summer, not just in this fantasy draft. Next up, I took a Doxa 300T Sea Rambler, which I really like. The silver dial with the orange accents looks even better, you know, just barely breaking the surface of some water, whether it be a pool, a lake, or the ocean. For my fourth pick, I went with the only of these that I actually have and wear quite a bit, the Garmin Fenix 6S Pro. Lots of active time during the summer, whether it be hiking or swimming or could it be kayaking or whatever. It's always good to have some metrics for that kind of thing, and the Fenix makes a pretty solid argument for kind of a tool smartwatch. And then finally, the Halios Fairwind, the forthcoming Halios Fairwind, which is just kind of like a gorgeous you know, indie diver from Vancouver that is one that I'm very much looking forward to.
Awesome. How do you feel about your chances?
I think I've got a fight for sure.
Anything controversial in here? Anything you think is going to either like push you over the top or kind of kneecap you here?
I think the AP is probably like a crowd favorite. It's such a fun watch. Like, I think you could even like not like Royal Oaks and still be like, oh, but that one is dope. And then I think, you know, there will always be a contingent of Hodinkee readers, and bless their hearts, they're not necessarily wrong, that just don't like smartwatches. And I totally get that. For me, if I actually like lay out the stuff I have on my desk, got one here, got another one in the drawer there. As long as you keep them charged, they're pretty handy. But I understand that they just functionally are more of an appliance than an object of fascination. Yeah. So I think that could probably maybe hurt my overall chances in a fantasy draft. But I'm pretty comfortable with the picks.
Okay. John, how about you? Let's hear what you got and how you're feeling about it.
Yeah, so I started off with the Bulgari Octofinissimo automatic with satin polished steel, which I think was my first pick. And I grabbed it, you know, mainly because I love that watch's design, but also because, you know, this is the first one from that family to have 100 meters of water resistance. So it's the first Octofinissimo that I think is like a very solid summer watch. So I chose that one. Then I went in a much more like tool watch kind of direction and picked the Tudor Pelagos left-hand drive for my second watch. So that had my, you know, my dive watch base covered. And then, you know, wanting to get something from Seiko or Grand Seiko into the mix, I picked up the Seiko Prospect Alpinist, which is just like a great wearing kind of, you know, comfortable everyday watch that I think is a great summer watch, but, you know, you can wear that year round, I think. And then I noticed, if I recall correctly, that the Panerai Submersible 42 was still on the table with my fourth pick. And so I went and snapped that up, even though I already had a dive watch. I think the submersible is, you know, I mean, it's like a design object. It's a Panerai with, you know, just that kind of iconic profile. And it's, I chose the one with that, you know, very beautiful shark skin gray dial. And I just remember when this watch dropped, I was like, God, that's a beautiful, beautiful submersible. And then, you know, wanting to get a quartz watch into the mix, wanting to get something digital with multifunctions, and not really seeing much, as I recall, left on the table in terms of smartwatches. I snapped up the G-Shock DW5600, which is, you know, I mean, that's a watch that I currently own one of them, and there's always a place for this watch in my collection, summer or not.
Nice. How do you feel about your chances here?
I think I've got a fighting chance, but I think there are some other very good collections here, so we'll have to wait and see.
All right. I will run through mine then, and then we'll get into the results. So I drafted the IWC Pilot's Watch Spitfire Automatic as just like a great everyday sports watch on a NATO. I drafted the Cartier Santos in steel on the bracelet. The Grand Seiko SBGA 413, which is the US spring edition. It's a spring drive watch. It's got this beautiful sort of like textured light pink dial. I think it's an amazing, amazing, amazing summer watch. Then I picked the Doxa Sub 200. I realized I didn't have a dive watch, so I went with something from Doxa. I also picked the Sea Rambler dial, the kind of like light silver. There's something about a light dial dive watch that I think is really, really special and cool. And that Beads of Rice bracelet is really awesome. And then last up, in the absence of any smartwatch choices or real digital watch choices, which I, you know, in all honesty, Cara, I was really gunning for that Apple Watch, but I ended up taking the Unimatic Modelo Uno, which to me is awesome. I remember seeing somewhere somebody described it as looking like an Italian studying abroad at the Bauhaus. I can't remember who wrote that where, but I love that. And I think that's a perfect
line.
Description. Yeah, exactly. Right. And I love that description of this. Like it's minimal, but it's still recognizable as a dive watch. I just think it's awesome. So I was glad there was room in my collection for that. Yeah, as far as my chances go, I think I've got a shot. I think this is a slightly idiosyncratic summer watch collection. I think the lack of smartwatch is a little strange, or some kind of digital like beater watch. The Cartier and the Grand Seiko are maybe a little dressier than what most people would think of for summer watches. So I don't really know. I think it's there's four strong collections here. I think four collections, each with their own personality. I mean, Cara's is a mix of classics like the Sub and the Nautilus with more colorful, fun things like the Zodiac and the Freestyle. I think James has kind of assembled like a perfect storm of like real, like badass tool watches here. I mean, we have the Plo Prof, we have the Doxa, we've got the AP, which is obviously an elevated version, and then even the Garmin and the Helios. I think John's collection has ended up being sort of like a mix of classics and design classics, you know, with the Bulgari and the submersible. And then I think maybe mine is just a little bit weird, to be honest. So we'll see what happens here. But Gray, you're the man with the results, right? You've got the envelopes?
Yes, sir. Let's do this. Let's break some hearts.
All right, let's break some hearts here. You want to do a count down from fourth place to first place?
Yep, you're the boss. Let's do it. Drum roll, please, for the fourth place. In fourth, we have with 20.6% of the vote, it is Mr. James Stacy.
Wow. I'm a little surprised there. Got to be honest.
Yeah. Me too. I thought your collection was Hot Watch Summer, but if that was 24%, that means it was a pretty close race.
Yeah, that's 20. A big percentage for, yeah. Well, still, that's a big percentage.
For, great
yeah.
Mental math, Cara. It was a very close race overall. Everyone was within 10 points of each other, 10 percentage points. And yes, James with 20.6 narrowly missed the third place designation.
Yeah, I took
James, I think that Garmin probably did you in, but I applaud you sticking to your guns
there. But James loves Garmin.
Yeah, it's five great watches. I wouldn't change my picks now.
You are.
Not for 3% more.
I like that.
I agree.
Okay. Fair enough. Moving right along to third place. Drum roll, please. Mr. John Buse with 22.3% of the vote.
All right. I'll take it. I'm happy with my picks too. So I'm interested to see who comes out on top.
Stevie.
Yeah? What are you thinking here, CB?
Shit. What if we tied?
We flipping a coin here, or what's going on?
Cage match.
I mean, for us to tie would be really difficult because this goes out to like two or three decimal places. It would be pretty pretty weird if we tied.
Okay.
A statistical tie, right?
Yeah. I'm getting a little anxious now. All right.
I know, me too.
All right, I won't leave you dangling any much longer. All right, second place.
Okay.
Drum roll, please. Do your virtual handshake, Cara and Steven. Second place goes to Miss Cara Barrett with 27.4% of the vote, meaning our champion,
SAP,
with 29.6%.
There you go, Steven.
Woo!
That's never happened before.
It's that wind that's been eluding you.
I know, man. Congrats. I keep coming up to bat and striking out. This is all right.
I think that Unimatic probably ended up helping you out, to be honest. I know that you wanted to go in another direction during the recording, but I think that Unimatic got you over the edge.
That was a good one.
I think you're probably right. I mean, Gray, what was the final percentage there?
Steven wins with 29.6% of the vote.
And what was Kara's percentage?
27.4.
Whoa.
Real time.
All right.
That's very close.
You beat me by a lot.
That's very close. So I got to say, I think my main takeaway from this is that we did a really good job picking the pre-selected watches here. That, you know, we've got 20 watches and it seems like people liked, you know, in the aggregate, all 20 of them. You know, there weren't any two or three watches that seemed to like kind of drag somebody down here or like push somebody way over the top.
Yes, I agree with that. I also think it was like quarters. I feel like the percentages were so close.
Yeah, I think that means we did a good job. I think that means everybody picked a pretty strong collection. And again, I think it means the watches we had to pick from were good.
Agreed. We spoke to the audience. Everybody found something that they loved. And that's really what matters.
Congrats on your win, Steve.
There are no winners here.
That's great. I love that Kara says there are no winners here because she didn't win.
That was a really
smart sort of soft way of being a sore loser. I applaud that, Kara.
I've really grown, Steven. Okay, leave me alone.
We all have. Okay, we've all grown.
Are we going to point out that Stevie took top prize with a watch that technically doesn't align with the rules?
So, all right, I can be the you know, guy standing on the podium here and, you know, raising the trophy over my head, but I've got a mea culpa here, which is that I screwed up. I accidentally put a watch on the list that violated the draft rules, and then I drafted that watch, and then I won with that watch. So technically, I think my name has to be scratched off the trophy at this point, but the IWC is technically only, not even technically, it is only 60 meters water resistant. I misread the spec page when I was looking through. Technically, everything here needed to be 100 meter water resistant. It does have a screw down crown, so I'm less worried about it. But technically, I violated the rules. So I guess, Kara, technically you win if I'm disqualified here.
Well, if we're playing this game, isn't the 70?
Yeah, the Nautilus also has some dive.
Tech also 60 meters.
So Steve and I are both disqualified.
Oh, boy.
John Buse.
John Buse,
everybody.
John
Buse
by default.
It's just two names with the asterisks next to them.
Yeah, yeah.
The Barry Bonds and Sammy Sosa of watch draft.
Ooh. Ooh, okay. Ooh.
Full juice,
man. It could be worse. I could be the Bill Buckner of fantasy drafts. So as long as I'm not doing that, I'm okay. Next time I got to pay attention more. That's what I've taken away from this. Not that I'm a winner, but that I'm an idiot. So thank you guys for being understanding, both the listeners and my long-suffering colleagues who I put through this whole exercise, only to find out I've made the list wrong. So thanks, guys.
Classic oop-de-oop.
Classic oop-de-oop. Sorry, guys. I'm a victim of my own play.
You know, we obviously the big reveal is the, you know, kind of centerpiece of this, but I do think it's worth circling back and talking a little bit about our collections, the watches we like best, the things that kind of eluded us. So, you know, I wonder, just to run back through, we can do it in the same order. I mean, if you had to pick one watch from your collection and you had to wear that watch every day from, let's say, like May to September, right? Mm. Which of your five watches, if it had to be your one watch of the summer, what are you going with? We'll start with Kara again.
I think the Sub.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just
any reason?
Just because, like, it just goes with everything. It's just like a classic. You just kind of can't, because, like, I think that's actually the most realistic watch that I would wear every day.
Fair enough. James, which of your five would you wear?
I mean, it's not a realistic answer, but I'd wear the AP for sure. It'd be so much fun. The real answer is probably the watch closest to something I actually own, which is the 300T. I would wear a 50th anniversary, which I think is a bit sweeter of a watch, but I have the Sea Rambler. It's lovely.
Nice. John?
I'd wear the Octofinissimo every day. I might a little bit nervous about, I might be a little bit nervous about some of the surfaces kind of getting scratched for like, you know, true summer wear, but that's the one that I would, you know, be happiest to put on every day during the summer.
Nice.
Love it.
Yeah, I think I'd go with the IWC. And I say that mostly because, you know, kind of similarly to James, like I own the Hodinkee limited edition IWC Pilot. And it's the watch I've been wearing most of the summer by far. I would say I probably wear it like 2/3 of the time this summer. It's just the fact that it's thin, it's on a NATO. It's like, to me, it's kind of a perfect, like, no bullshit summer watch. Yeah. All right, I think let's go back through. And is there a watch that you didn't get to draft? Maybe it wasn't on the pre-approved draft list, but a summary watch that you would have wanted if, you know, there had been fewer rules or if we had done the list a little bit differently. Mm. Cara, you want to go first?
I think I'm going to steal your Modelo Uno.
Interesting. How about the Messina Labs limited edition one? John, you own one of those, right?
I actually do. Yeah, that's a fantastic watch. That's awesome. I've actually been wearing it a lot this summer.
It's a Modelo Uno, but it's like, it's got a tropical vibe. It's I could see you rocking that, Cara.
Yeah, I think they do a really nice job, and I agree. I think it's like, it's a great summer watch. So
yeah.
So yeah, I would go. I mean, I think I had the opportunity to pick that one, but just to round out my collection, I didn't, because it was very similar to the Sub for me. But I really like those watches. I think they're great. So that's my pick.
Cool. James?
This is watches, picks we would change?
Yeah, you don't even have to swap anything out, but like, is there a watch you wish you could have in your summer watch collection that like didn't make it in? It can even be something that we weren't, you know, that wasn't on the table to be drafted.
Yeah, I think as far as these picks go, you know, I think in an ideal world, the Ploprof wouldn't, the no date version of the Ploprof wouldn't have pushed it into a $5 category. It broke so we had to go with the date version. I actually think this is the only 430 date that I don't mind. If you look at the image, it almost disappears in the minute track, but it's still a 430 date. And if I'm spending like $10,000 on a watch, that's going to bug me. So I would go with the no date version without question. Otherwise, like I said, with the Sub 300, I vastly prefer the 50th anniversary models, but of course those were all sold out immediately in 2017. And then beyond, you know, a watch I wear a lot in the summer is my Explorer 2, but it's the last gen. So it's not something you can get now. I assume it's not that easy to buy, the current gen, but it's also it's the 42 millimeter version with the kind of Precioni inspired hand and that kind of thing. And I really prefer the 16570, with its kind of more svelte case, but that white dial works year round, obviously polar. I guess maybe it makes more sense with, snow gear rather than swim trunks, but it's pretty sweet on a bracelet and has decent water resistance as well. So
nice. John, what are you thinking?
Looking at what I did draft, I kind of wish that I drafted a bit more color into the collection. And so I'm just looking at some of the watches that you guys picked. Like, I think Kara's like Zodiac Seawolf was a great pick. James with the Royal Oak Offshore Diver, great pick. And then Steven, you with the Grand Seiko that you selected. I kind of wish that like that you know, aspect of you know, summer watch design was a little bit better represented in what I had in my collection.
Yeah, that's fair. I'm gonna go the opposite direction from you, John, and I'm gonna pick like an extremely austere watch. No surprises there for anyone. I kind of wish I could have picked the Tudor Black Bay 36. As a diehard 1016 lover, that's kind of the other watch I've been wearing a lot this summer. You know, the BB36 is the closest thing you can buy on the market today to a 1016 from the Rolex family. And I just think it's an incredible watch. I think 36 millimeters is such a versatile size. That watch wears great on a bracelet. It wears great on a NATO. It wears great on like a super thin Perlon strap. And it's basically a 1016 that you can jump in a pool with or take to the beach. So I think in an ideal world, I would have taken that, but we put the Pelagos on our list as Tudor's representative in this draft, which I stand behind. I think ultimately the Pelagos is more kind of representative of what we were going for here, but I would have loved that BB36 in my collection. So I think that's all the time we got, but thank you guys for doing this. As always, I think judging by the popularity of this, we're going to be doing another fantasy draft sometime soon. Maybe we'll do another one as we transition to fall. Maybe we'll do a no bracelets, like an all leather straps fantasy draft. I would say if you're listening, go visit the site and drop us a note in the comments or hit us up on Instagram and let us know what fantasy draft you would like to see. We'll do another one in a couple weeks. So let us know your ideas and we'll try to incorporate those in. But John, Cara, James, Gray, thanks everybody for doing this. Despite my totally blowing the rules, I appreciate you all being good sports here. And yeah, we'll have to have you guys back on again soon.
You're not cheating.
Always
you're not
a blast.
Thanks, Stevie. Congratulations.
Thanks, team. Talk to you guys soon.
See you soon, guys. Bye.
Up next, we've got my conversation with Cole Pennington and Jack Forster about their contributions to Volume 6 of the Hodinkee magazine. Hey, guys. Good to see you. How you doing?
Hey there, Stevie.
Doing okay. How you doing?
Good. I'm happy. We're gonna talk some Hodinkee magazine, which always makes me happy. My favorite topic.
Me too.
Cool. Well, I wanted to have you guys on the show here because a couple weeks ago we dropped Volume 6 of the Hodinkee magazine, which I cannot believe we're already on Volume 6. But you guys both contributed pretty heavy hitting stories to this volume. And I thought it'd be fun to have you on the show to talk about kind of the reporting process and what you learned and to give people a little bit of a preview to your story in case they haven't read it yet. And then for those who have, they'll get the behind the scenes stuff. So does that sound good?
Sounds fantastic. Steven, how did you find the whole sort of creative process this time around?
I thought it was great. I think, you know, I'm always shocked. Like we get in this world with the website, which both of you will know well, where, you know, we're focused on the news, we're trying to crank things out quickly, it's day to day, we're often in a rush. And the magazine is this nice chance to kind of like step back and think big. Like we're producing two of them a year. Often the stories take 6 to 12 months to put together. And it's great. And we kind of turn people loose too. Like it's really interesting sitting around the table with our team who is normally very focused on watches, vintage watches, new releases, news, whatever, and say, like, if you could read any story about a car, what would it be? If you could interview any collector, who would it be? If you could write a story about architecture or food or travel, like, what's your dream story? And everybody brings the heat every time. So I found it tremendously fulfilling as usual. I don't know. What did both of you think of the process this time around?
I'm sweating just thinking about it.
No pressure, Cole.
You know, it's funny how the amount of work expands to fill the available time, even though we only publish twice a year.
Very true.
Once we get close to deadline, it feels like we're publishing it daily.
Yeah, and I mean, for people who are not behind the scenes on this, so basically everyone except the three of us here, you know, people may not realize that, like, Jack edits every word that's in this magazine. Like, if you're reading it on the page, Jack has seen it and signed off on it. So it's, for Jack especially, as stuff comes to a head at the end and we get stuff in layout and we're really, like, passing around proofs, like, Jack is reading every word 3, 4, 5 times under deadline, trying to make sure that, you know, typos don't slip through and that we're fact-checking everything properly. So it's really... Yeah, like you said, it fills the available time, and especially I feel like on the back end, Jack, you feel the pressure there pretty hard.
Well, you know, I think we all do. I mean, I know that, I can't take credit for, I feel even a tenth of what goes into the magazine in terms of editorial labor. I feel like, you carry a lot of that. Our design team carries a lot of it. There's a lot of eyes on this product, and I'm happy to say I think we can all feel pretty proud of each issue. You know, there's always things that can improve, but boy, oh boy, I like it more with every issue.
I would agree. So with that in mind, Jack, I think let's start with your big story for this issue, which you wrote about a car, a slightly bigger, beautiful mechanical object than what you typically write about. Can you give us a little taste of what this story is about, and then we'll talk about some of the behind the scenes stuff?
Sure. It's a really wonderful, it was a really wonderful story, and I felt very, very lucky to be able to write it. So the basic, the core of the story is that in the early 1950s, there was a gentleman who was the CEO of a calendar company, and this was during a time when calendars were huge, huge business in the United States. And the gentleman's name was Charles A. Ward, and he had really built himself up from nothing to become the CEO of this giant publishing firm. Basically, the company was so big that there was a period in U.S. history when there was one calendar from this company for every three Americans. That's how sort of huge it was. And wow. You know, they did everything that you could possibly imagine: desktop calendars, wall calendars, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Charles Ward had actually met the guy who owned the company when they were both in prison. Ward was in prison on a narcotics rap, which he always claimed was trumped up. And before that, he had an extremely checkered past. He'd done things like worked for Pancho Villa during the Mexican Revolution and stolen cattle to feed his troops down in Texas. So this was a guy who'd been around a little bit. And when he got out of prison, he sort of turned his entire life around, went to work for the company, and rose up through the ranks to eventually become president after the owner's demise. And his leadership was so important that a bunch of his sales reps got together, 50-some-odd guys got together, and they bought him this car as a Christmas present. But it was not any ordinary car. It was an Aston Martin DB24, and the DB24 was an early DB series Aston Martin. DB stands for David Brown. David Brown was the owner of Aston Martin. And the car did not have a stock body. The bodywork was actually done by Bertone. And the bodywork is absolutely gorgeous. It's an unbelievable car to look at. Fire engine red with a wonderful long nose and beautiful bright work and these wonderful sort of elegant swooping lines. I mean, it's a car that looks like it's doing 110 miles an hour sitting still. Of course, by modern standards, you know, I mean, it's hopelessly technically obsolete by modern standards, non-synchronized clutch in the whole nine yards. But, you know, just as a piece of absolutely classic, gorgeous, mid-century automotive design, I think it's maybe the most beautiful car I've ever seen, certainly one of the top 10. Mm-hmm. And the guy who owns the car actually has bought it twice. He bought it, sold it at auction, and immediately regretted it. And I think 6 years later, you know, bought it back again because he missed it so much. But in any case,
that's how you know something's good, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So nice. You bought it twice.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And probably paid a lot more for it the second time.
I'm sure.
Yeah, it's crazy the amount of detail that went into the car. You know, I mean, it was designed for the extremely wealthy and very outgoing gentleman of leisure, which Charles Ward certainly was. He was over 6 feet tall, penchant for loud suits, liked to wear cowboy hats, and the car really suited his personality. It is effervescently beautiful. It came with, I think there's a couple of medallions on the car with his initials on them. There's a plaque under the hood inscribed with the names of all of the guys who chipped in to buy this car. It was, I think, the most expensive car sold in the United States the year that it was sold. So this was not an inexpensive Christmas present. And it even came with a picnic basket. And this was no ordinary picnic basket. You know, cutlery and silverware and, you know, beautiful handmade wooden box. I mean, just the whole thing was just amazing. It's the kind of car you would take out maybe twice a year to take your lady love on a, you know, picnic to remember. But boy, oh boy, would you enjoy the drive. Oh, and a ragtop, of course.
Yeah. That's wild. I love the image of some dude in a giant cowboy hat driving this car around the United States in the 50s. Like, it's so crazy to imagine what that must have looked like. Like, we can appreciate this car looking back, but imagining what that car would have looked like to contemporaries at the time, it must have looked unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, it looks so unbelievable today and makes such an impression today. We actually had a chance to ride around in it a little bit during the photo shoot. And, you know, it's a showstopper. I mean, you know, people were digging out their cell phones to take pictures. It was just an incredibly satisfying car to drive around in. And it's not the kind of car that sort of like elicits envy or makes people want to key scratch it when they see it. You know, it just makes people, it makes people feel happy. You know, it's not a go to, it's not a go to hell car. It's not a, you know, look what I got that you don't have car. It's just something that everybody kind of wants to celebrate when they see it. I mean, that's how good it is. Yeah, it was a wonderful, wonderful experience, you know, just to get driven around in it. I didn't actually have a chance to drive it because it's got a non-synchronized clutch, and I think I probably would have gotten about 5 feet before, you know, before stalling out. But it was sure fun to sit up front and, you know, just cruise around on a bright, cold day and experience this amazing automobile.
Did you wear a cowboy hat and a loud suit?
No. No, I worry.
We should have gotten that photo and put that on the cover. That would have been, speaking of showstoppers, that would have been pretty incredible.
Yeah, it was actually, I forget what I wore, but whatever it was, it wasn't enough. It was a freezing cold day with a really, really high wind. And, you know, you sort of don't get that when you look at the pictures, but we were freezing our butts off by the end of the day.
Yeah. I mean, Cole, you're much more of a car guy than I am, but like, this is a car that when I heard about it, like I had never heard this before. Like I didn't know that Bertone had done a series of DB2 Fours.
It's not really a series either, though. Like it's not even a series. Yeah.
Right. A small collection of cars. But like, was this something on your radar? Like, is this in the car mythos, or is this kind of like even outside?
I would say it's outside of like your standard like classic car guys realm. This is like a one-off, totally weird thing that a lot of the owners of these cars and so forth keep it kind of private. So it's like you don't really know. Yeah, this to learn about this car is certainly, you know, unique and interesting. It's not part of like what everyone already knows. Like this is actually an original story, you know.
That's great. I mean, Jack, was there anything that as you reported this out, like anything that stands out to you as the most surprising thing you learned or the most interesting thing that you learned? And it can be something that made it into the story or not, but just like the thing that to you stands out from the experience of reporting this.
I mean, the car is such a beautiful object in itself without knowing anything about the story behind it. You know, if you're at all sensitive to sort of great design, you can't look at it without just feeling really, really carried away. But that said, to me, one of the most fascinating things about the whole thing was the people story that's behind it. You know, the car was purchased from a guy named, his nickname was Wacky, Wacky Arnold, who was one of the first Aston Martin dealer. I think he might have been the first Aston Martin dealer, certainly in his area, maybe in the United States. And he had actually made his fortune during World War II selling small watercraft engines to the U.S. Navy, which I guess in World War II was a huge business. And then after the war, he went on to get into another business, which was selling high-end automobiles. And you know, Aston Martin was one of them. And he actually ran into Bertone at an auto show, I think in 1951, maybe. I'd have to double-check back in the story. But, you know, Bertone was still in super, super cash-poor, you know, post-World War II mode. And Arnold actually ordered 200 bodies from Bertone, but only six of them ended up on DB2 Fours. So there, it's a super rare car. There's one other one that I know of that's in the UK. Just tracking down these, you know, these six cars was, you know, a tremendously exciting thing to do because it took a little bit of detective work. You know, there's bits and pieces, you know, sort of all over the place about those six, maybe seven bodies that went on DB2 Fours. And they're all beautiful. But this one is, I think, by far the most striking. And, you know, of course, Charles Ward was a fantastic story, too. I mean, you know, a ex-cattle rustler, ex-narcotics smuggler turned a calendar mogul. That's the kind of thing that I think could only happen in the, you know, it certainly couldn't happen now. You know, 1940s, 1950s was a good time for that sort of thing.
That's awesome. Well, you know, you traveled to Connecticut to report this, but Cole traveled a little bit further for his story kind of right before global travel shut down. I think Cole might have been, Cole, you might actually have been the last Hodinkee editor to travel internationally this year.
That's true.
To report this story. Yeah, that is true?
Yeah.
That's awesome. So you went to Aarhus, Denmark, to report on the world's foremost collector of Bang & Olufsen tube radios, which is a story that you and I have been working on for, what, a year and a half, probably?
Yeah, a long time.
But I'm pretty excited with how it turned out. Can you give people, I'll let you give people the kind of like TLDR version
right now. The TLDR is, there's a fellow, well, first off, yeah, okay, we'll start there. There's a guy named Jan Togersen, a Dane, who has amassed, yeah, the most comprehensive collection of tube radios, but that even in itself is kind of misleading. He's got everything that Bang & Olufsen has done, which even includes, as you'll see in the story, electric shavers. That's what they produced. Yeah. That saved the company too. But what's super interesting about Jan is he's got that, I think we've talked about it. We've talked about this a million times, but the collector gene, right? So,
right.
What do I know about tube radios? What did I know going into this? Not much, but it all worked out beautifully because that collector gene, you just, you know, immediately establish a relationship and so forth. And then he really walked me through the collection and how he came to amass the collection, which that's the most fascinating part. But the thing that I found interesting was the design element of Bang & Olufsen. You kind of, you know, prior to the story, I knew that they were one of the most high-end audio brands, like kind of mass consumer audio brands. And when I went there and started talking to Jan, he pointed out how like some of the surfaces and so forth mirrored automotive design of the time. And and seeing them in front of you, you kind of like what Jack said, like you can't help but just appreciate how beautiful this thing is. So yeah, he's got this collection in a industrial park in the basement of a building in an industrial park outside of Aarhus, which that's kind of interesting too. Aarhus is nothing like Copenhagen and so forth. It's totally different. It's on Jutland, the other side of Denmark, and it's like Germanic. It's the Germanic portion. Mm. So it's a port as well. So it's kind of an industrial city, I guess I would say. Like, it's not, yeah. It's kind of a neat place too. So went down and Jan walked me through the collection, and you could read the story on how he got some of these things, but he developed relationships with royalty in the Middle East. He would literally get in his car and drive all over continental Europe, knock on people's doors and ask like, "Hey, do you have an old radio hanging around?" Which at the time wasn't uncommon. People did. People had radios just hanging out in their garages. So, and he bought them, and he saw, not only is he super passionate about it, and that drove this, but he also saw the value or that they would become valuable at some point when no one else did. So he was the guy who kind of, he knew that these radios were so important to not just the audio world, but also really Denmark. It's a kind of a national pride thing as well.
You know, Cole, it's funny. There's so much eye candy in that story. You know, these are such beautiful, it's one sort of amazing classic, you know, high-end audiophile design after another. And I don't think I mentioned this to you when you were working on the story, but I actually have a Beogram 9000 system, which is, I think it's from quite a bit later, and it's something that, you know, modern audiophiles might be a little bit more familiar with. But my mom got it as a retirement present. She used to be an editor at Stereo Review.
Oh, wow.
And still got it in my apartment. You know, and it's a beautiful thing to look at. So for me, you know, I wouldn't call myself a Bang & Olufsen enthusiast necessarily, because I don't know the company's history of production nearly well enough to sort of, you know, claim that title. But it was great looking at the story and seeing, you know, where some of the design language for the system that I have came from.
Yeah, it's and that's the thing. That's what's cool about it. You can easily trace it, right? It's a lot like Rolex or a lot like Porsche 911, like it small iterations over time and they to create the best product. So you should have mentioned that. I would have included in the story. It's a celebrity cameo from Jack Forrester. You know?
One of the things I love about this, Cole, when you put all these items next to each other, I mean, you said you can kind of trace things. is, you know, the way that Bang & Olufsen uses materials is so fascinating. The use of woods and bakelite and brushed metal and like all of these different things and the way that they transform over time, but they still feel connected to one another. So, you know, you can have a radio from, you know, 1970s that's mostly aluminum, and you can have a radio from the 1950s that's mostly wood and bakelite, and yet like they feel of a kind in a way. And I think that's a really hard thing to achieve, and the way that Jan has assembled this collection really, like, it's not just a collection, it's also in some ways like it tells a story. It's an encyclopedia, but one that you can like walk through and touch, as opposed to just like reading on a page.
Right. And also the level of scholarship that he has carried out, it's very, very high. I mean, he's written a bunch and so forth. He's kind of the go-to guy. But I'll tell you one thing that didn't make it into the story, if you want to hear.
Great. Would love to.
Which was just super, super cool. So yes, Jan is the foremost collector of Bang & Olufsen. But after we went through that, you know, went through the collection, whatever, you know, we're there. I mean, we're essentially guests in a way. And he took it upon himself to bring us into another world of his, which is shortwave radio. So
he's
a hammy.
Interesting.
And what we did is, after, you know, we went from this industrial park, we followed him, you know, we rented a car, Josh Perez, who shot the story, and we rented a car and followed him through these small villages and stopped at a bakery, got some awesome cake, croissant, stuff like that. And then we pull up to this farmhouse. It's pretty much what literally looks like a bunker, an old house, and some weird shed with a satellite dish. A massive, I'm talking about like the satellite itself. It's not, it's an antenna, but that is the size of a house. So pull up, go inside, and he takes us into a studio and says, yeah, this is what I do pretty much in my free time. Like, I built this just for shortwave radio. And he's actually spoken through shortwave radio with people on the ISS. That's how into it he is.
Interesting.
And he gave us a demo, and we chatted with a guy from Russia and then also a guy from like Indiana or something while we were in Denmark.
It's pretty incredible that he could actually talk to the ISS with his setup. I didn't even know that was possible with shortwave.
It is like, so he explained it to me. I'm not a shortwave expert. Like, I have so much to learn, but this inspired me to learn it. But things have to line up. It's a special occasion. It wasn't like, you can't just call up the ISS. Like, it was a special thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I had a ham radio license back in the day in high school. I don't think I've used a short or long wave radio in, you know, a long time. But I know that you can, like, you can do things like, you know, with an antenna that size, you can like bounce signals off the moon and stuff. Like, you can do wild stuff. And it sounds like Jan is that level of crazy.
He built himself an entire bunker and giant antenna and things like that. So that was awesome. So cool, just to go from the Bang & Olufsen. So I was, you know, in work mode, like doing, you know, really, you know, taking notes, this and that. Then immediately go to like this, learn something entirely new where I don't have to worry about writing a story about it. I could just get into it. And it was just like, it was very,
that's
very cool.
Cool.
Yeah. So that was that. And it was a great story. And really, so that's the last time I traveled, period. And I kind of miss it. So.
Well, I am glad we could get you over there and make this story happen. It would have been a bummer if this one had to pass because of the travel restrictions, but we made it. We made it happen.
Sometimes you get lucky.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to plug the story I wrote for this issue, which did not involve any travel. It was done exclusively in the office. But I did get to see some pretty awesome watches and learn about a watch that for some reason had just never, I had never gotten an opportunity to dive deep on it. And that's the Tag Heuer Carrera. So, you know, obviously, you know, it's a big anniversary year for Tag this year. It's the 160th anniversary of the brand. So we decided to do something big on, you know, what is arguably the most important watch to ever come from Tag or Heuer, you know? And it was really fascinating diving into this and like, you know, reading, you know, rereading parts of Jack Heuer's autobiography and really kind of diving into like the essence of this watch. 'Cause, you know, one of the challenges we always have with stories like Reference Points, and Jack, I know you've experienced this firsthand, is, you know, there's often too much. Like, you can't actually cover everything. So you have to figure out how to organize it. You have to figure out what to include and what not to include. And, you know, as a person who, like, before I wrote this, I would not have said I was an expert on the Carrera. And so I don't want to be making arbitrary judgment calls about, you know, these Carreras are important and these aren't. So it means talking to experts, guys like Jeff Stein. It means talking to folks in the archive and the museum at Tag Heuer. It means reading Jack Heuer's autobiography and trying to get his perspective on what mattered. And ultimately, I think I was able to, with lots of help from lots of people, collectors, enthusiasts, the folks at Tag Heuer, and some of my colleagues, you know, I think put together a pretty nice portrait of this watch that is, I think, one of the most important watches of the 20th century. I mean, I don't know what you guys think about that, but I think the Carrera is one of the most important watches of the 20th century.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. It's a cultural icon, certainly, a design icon. You know, it's been a part of watchmaking history and played such an important part in watchmaking history and in watch design. And it's been a vehicle for so many, you know, different and interesting versions. I think that it definitely deserves that that particular accolade. I actually love the story. I mean, sure. I learned a lot reading it.
Oh, thank you.
I think one of the amazing things about writing about watches is, you know, we're of necessity generalists. You know, we sort of have to know a bit about everything, and you know, we all have our you know, thing that we'd like to focus on. I'm, you know, fascinated by antiquarian horology and, you know, things that nobody else cares about, like escapement design. But you know, you talk to somebody like Jeff Stein, who really does have a bread in the bone, granular knowledge of you know, the subject matter, and you know, you realize yeah. why people specialize. You know, you know, you talk to somebody who you know, their thing is Tag Heuer, you know, and Heuer, their thing is you know, the Carrera, and they're just going to have observations, insights, and a level of knowledge that I don't think I am ever going to have about any one subject in horology, just because you know, I have to look fairly broadly at everything in order to be able to write about everything. And you know, what we all do is we get our teeth into a story and then we research it, and then we go to people like Jeff in order to, you know, fill in the blanks. But it does keep it endlessly fascinating, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And you know, for me, one of the reasons I found this project so fascinating is, like, I am not an automotive enthusiast. I am not a racing enthusiast. Like, I think I've watched maybe two or three F1 races in my entire life. You know, like, I'm not a car guy in that way. And the Carrera is so closely tied to automotive history that, like, I had to learn about cars in order to be able to write about this watch. And ultimately, I think I came out of this both appreciating the watch in a new way and appreciating, like, where it comes from, like, the origins, the cultural origins of it in a new way. And one of the things I found really compelling, and this I don't think will surprise anybody who knows where my interests lie, is, you know, that so many watches that are what we would call, like, icons, you know, things like the Submariner, the Daytona, the Nautilus, the Royal Oak, like, these watches are largely defined by a consistent visual language, right? Like, a Daytona today looks largely the same as a Daytona from the 1970s. A Royal Oak today looks largely like an A-Series Royal Oak. Like, they're pretty similar. Carreras today don't look like Carreras from the 60s. Like, they just don't. But it was interesting trying to find the threads and the through lines that connect these things. And it's interesting that for Jack Heuer, from the beginning, the Carrera was not about any one visual cue. It was about the ideas behind the design. It was about legibility. It was about clarity. It was about getting rid of things that aren't essential. It was about having a movement that felt good to use. It was about all of these like less obvious things. And once you figure that out, you can start to see the ways in which, like, a 2447N, you know, an original Carrera, and a Carrera Heuer 02 from today, and even, like, some of the more experimental crazy stuff, like the micrograph and the microgirder and whatever, like, you can see how these things connect to one another. And I think that, for me, gave me an additional appreciation for sort of, like, what the folks at Tag and then Tag Heuer were doing to sort of make this an enduring thing, a thing that would continue to matter going forward, instead of just being a relic that we could kind of like look back on and say like, oh, how beautiful was that?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
I like that take, Stevie.
Thanks, man. So yeah, I think, you know, the big takeaway for me from this story is, and it's something I'm going to try to do more personally, but I would encourage, you know, the folks listening to this to do too, would be like, find a watch that that other people like, that is popular, is important, is historical, that you don't connect with, and like go deep on it, like go take a look. And like, I'd always liked the 244N Carreras. I almost bought one a while back, and you know, go deep on it and like figure out why you might like it. And ultimately you might not, like ultimately you might not connect with it, but like I think that exercise is good, and it'll kind of like teach you about what you do and don't like from a more conceptual standpoint, instead of just saying like, I like this watch, I don't like that watch, I like this watch, I don't like that watch. You'll start to say, this is what I like about watches, this is what I don't like about watches. So I don't know, that's if I have any advice to give, that is what I learned from writing this story, in addition to now actually knowing something about Carrera reference numbers, which I did not know anything about heading into this. But yeah, it was a fun experience.
On a completely unrelated topic, well, not completely unrelated because it's still in the magazine. You know what was kind of a moving story for me to read, just from a sort of, oh my gosh, I wish the hell I could go there standpoint, was Yu Sakaguchi's City Guide to Tokyo. And, you know, I've been there a couple of times for work. And, you know, we're always, you're on such a tight schedule when you're there. You're lucky if you have kind of like one night out to knock around. And even though, you know, I've had a chance to go there a couple of times. Cole, I know you've been through there as well. And I didn't recognize a single one of the places that are his, you know, sort of favorites in Tokyo. And, you know, it just made me say, gosh, you know, you take it for granted, but we were really lucky to be able to travel that much. And I want to go to every single one of those places when I finally get over there again. Whenever the hell that is.
I agree, Jack. Oof, do I agree. And for people who may not know, Yu Sakaguchi is the editor-in-chief of Hodinkee.jp, of Hodinkee Japan, and is like maybe the most tasteful guy I know. He's pretty on point. So I'm with you, Jack. I'm dying to get back to Tokyo and to go check some of these places out.
I'm moving to Tokyo.
But you're moving to Tokyo? All right. That's fine. Jack, Cole's going to run the Tokyo Bureau. Is that fine with you?
It works for me. I think he's the man for the job.
I mean, we actually have a Tokyo Bureau, so that probably wouldn't work. There's already people running the Tokyo Bureau. But I wonder, Cole, did you have a story similarly to Jack? Did you have a story that you didn't write that you want to like quickly recommend to people before we head out?
I think James's perpetual planner, the deep dive into the perpetual planet program that Rolex put on, I think, to me, that's interesting, A, because it's actually helping change the world. But, you know, talking about watches is always about the watch, but this is a watch company doing something totally different. And,
yeah,
you know, the Sylvia Earle connection, all that. So that to me is probably the story. It's not really a story like in the traditional sense. There's no narrative arc or whatever, but it's some insight into something super, super interesting. I think James did a great job at highlighting what Rolex is doing, and the fact that Rolex is doing it, I found very, very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to recommend it. James's other story from this issue, which is a story about super high end perpetual calendars, and specifically sporty perpetual calendars. So, James basically took a combined look at the Audemars Piguet RD2, the watch that used to be called the RD2, the Vacheron Overseas Perpetual Calendar Ultra Thin, and then the Patek 5740 Nautilus Perpetual Calendar. And to have these three watches in the same place at the same time was ridiculous, honestly. You know, I think we all see a lot of great watches and get to handle them, and they're in our office and our photo studio every day, really. But this was the last shoot that I worked on before quarantine started, and before we worked from home. Actually, the office was actually officially closed when Tiffany, our photographer, and I worked on this together. And to have these three watches basically to ourselves in an office for a day was a real treat. And I think Tiffany's photos came out amazing. James's story is really awesome insight into like real rarefied horological air. And I think if you're somebody at all interested in that kind of watchmaking, like this is a treat. Like this is just pure pleasure for a couple pages. So I'd recommend people check that out. Thank you guys for doing this. It's good to get some additional insights. I mean, despite the fact that I, you know, worked with both of you as you were putting these stories together, I just learned some new things about these stories from you. Hopefully people listening did as well. And soon enough, I know Jack is already hard at work on a story for volume 7.
Yeah.
Cole, I think you're probably getting a story assignment next week. So
I'm sweating.
Soon enough, we'll be back on air making another one of these about volume 7.
Sweet. Well, I'm ready.
Yep. Looking forward to it. Thanks for having us on the show, Stephen. And I had a great, great time working on that car story. You know, I mean, I love watches, but boy, oh boy. You know, riding around in that thing, after about 5 seconds, I was like, the hell with watches, man. I want to be a car journalist.
Yeah, it looks like, Stevie, you're into cars now. Jack's into cars now. We should just do a car podcast. You know, I
oh, boy. All right. Now I'm sweating, Cole. All right. I think with that, we'll leave people. And thanks for doing this, guys.
All right. Thanks
again,
all.
Steven. Good seeing you both.
Likewise.
And to finish things off today, I chat with our founder and CEO, Ben Clymer, about his profile of the artist Wes Lang. Good to see you, Ben. How's it going?
You too, man. Great to see you. Happy one day after your birthday.
Thanks, man. Appreciate that. Now everybody's going to know how close to the wire we record these things. But that's
yeah,
exactly. Cool. Well, we're doing a little debrief on the magazine this week, on volume 6 of the magazine. And one of the big centerpieces to the issue was a profile you wrote of the artist Wes Lang. And I wanted to get you on to chat about what it was like meeting Wes and being in his studio and seeing his watch collection.
Sure. Yeah. Happy to help.
So I wonder, like, how did Wes first end up on your radar as a watch collector?
Yeah.
I mean, I think we're both familiar with his art, but like, how did you realize that he was in the watch world?
Yeah. It's one of those things. I mean, Wes Lang, as I mentioned in the story, I actually had one of Wes's prints in my home many years ago that belonged to somebody I was very close with. And it just never really, you know, I knew who he was. I knew his name. I knew about the Yeezy stuff and, you know, the Grateful Dead stuff early on. And he was on my radar, but never really kind of, you know, really delved deep into who Wes was or why he was as kind of well known as he is. And then one day, Aziz Ansari texted me and he was like, hey, you know Wes Lang? I said, yes. He's like, you really got to meet this guy. Like, you're going to love him. And, you know, it's everybody thinks that their friends are watch people. You know what I mean? And it's just like, I, you know, and Aziz is you know, dialed in enough to know that, like, okay, we're at a different level of watch person when it comes to the Hodinkee gang, you know? So, you know, I took it seriously. And then one time I was in Los Angeles and I had a free afternoon and I got his phone number and I was like, hey, dude, like, you know, I'm, you know, Ben from Hodinkee here, like, would love to swing by. He's like, oh, for sure. Come on by. And so I went down to his studio in downtown LA. And I was just awestruck. I mean, it really was one of the coolest spaces, you know, forget the watches for a moment, the coolest spaces, the coolest vibes. He's got such an amazing, warm, interesting vibe. That was just really struck me as like somebody who's got it kind of all figured out. And it's just like, you know, we get to meet so many fascinating, intelligent, successful people, even. But he had a different kind of aura around him that was like very, very like slow paced, very thoughtful, very his own. And that was really wonderful and enlightening. And then it came down to the watches. And, you know, Aziz had told me he's like a hardcore Hodinkee guy, hardcore watch guy. And I said, cool. And then I started speaking to him. And like, you know, that's an understatement. I mean, Wes is one of the most serious, most interesting watch collectors I know in the United States. And it's different than I even said in the story. Like, I kind of assumed that because he's an artist and in downtown L.A., like there's kind of a uniform of like, you know, wealthy, successful young guys in watches. And that's like vintage Daytona, vintage Submariner, maybe a Royal Oak, like, you know, all the stuff that we all love, but like, okay, like, you know, we've all seen it 1,000 times. Right. That's what I expected. And it's not at all what I got. Or I should say I got that plus 1,000 other things, you know, and that includes a real love for Grand Seiko. And yes, he has Nietzsche, but also like, You know, he's got a Snowflake. You know, he has an Acrivia. He's got a Kodoki. You know, he's got some really fascinating. He's got really interesting stuff. And I was just like, you are not the normal, you know, watch collector. The normal watch collector is buying Rolexes, maybe Omegas, you know, AP Patek, blah blah blah. And he just you know marches to his own beat. And so, you know, we just kind of became friends. And, you know, it's one of those things where, like, you meet somebody that's kind of like young and interesting, that's into watches in a sincere way, but is not part of the industry. And that's the big difference. It's like you meet so many people that are like, oh, are kind of like gentleman dealers or work for somebody, or are just kind of like around, you know, kind of around this world. And then you find somebody that like just loves watches as a collector. And like, that's so much more enjoyable than, you know, kind of being somebody that like, hey, can I use Hodinkee to sell watches or whatever, you know? And so we just became really friendly. And then one day I was like, hey man, like, would be awesome to do a story in the magazine. And then it kind of went on from there. And, you know, I think the story turned out pretty well. I'm happy with it. And, you know, it's been a cool experience getting to know him for sure.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. I think the story came out great. And I think it was the way the story was put together was cool, because it started obviously from this organic place of you guys becoming friends and having these conversations informally. But then you got to go with a photographer, this guy, Pete Halverson, who is a friend of the show and been on Hodinkee Radio before. And you and Pete got to go to the studio for the afternoon to like see some work, see some watches. Yeah. What was it like getting to spend that afternoon kind of in Wes's world?
Yeah, I mean, look, Wes remains one of my favorite people. Like, he's a kind of person that like inspires me to be kind of like more true to myself, if that makes any sense, which I think we you know, could all use a little bit of. You know, he's just like, Wes does what he wants to do, and almost at sometimes at other people's expense, you know, really, you know, just in terms of relationships, etc. But he's like, look, man, like, I do this the way that I want to do it, and like, you know, I don't have to listen to anybody else, and I'm living my life for me. And that is something that I, you know, again, that I wish I could, you know, kind of, you know, push forward for myself. And he's just this guy that, like, he's just different. You know, I know other artists just like you. I know the photographers, you know, just like you. But, like, this guy operates in his own kind of, you know, kind of environment. And it's really encouraging and really, like, it's inspiring, to be honest with you. You know, he does what he wants to do the way that he wants to do it. And creates art that, like, if people like it, great. Thankfully, they do, so he can, you know, afford all these nice watches.
Yeah.
But if they didn't, like, I don't think he would really change. And, like, you know, if you look at some of the stuff that he did as a younger person when he had nothing, you know, it's exactly the same stuff. You know, like, the media may have changed a little bit. The, you know, the price certainly has changed a lot. But, like, what he's creating hasn't changed at all. And the fact that he was able to make that work is amazing. And the other wonderful thing about it is that, like, he knows how lucky he is. And I don't mean lucky in the sense of, like, he's not talented. Lucky in the sense that people appreciate what he's doing for exactly what it is and can afford to pay for it, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, getting to spend more time with him in person was wonderful. And then again, we've become, you know, really good friends since. But he's just a different guy. And he's just like, you know, as we said in the story, like, you know, his appreciation for Grand Seiko, it's like, it's a different kind of satisfaction, but it's satisfaction for himself and nobody else. You know, it's like, it's a pride in craft and understanding, as opposed to like, hey, I made it. But he's also, he said some really, you know, kind of thoughtful things about, like, you know, the whole idea of like stunting on people. And it's like, he's like, yeah, like, sometimes I'll put on a 5004 5970 and be like, yeah, I can afford this. I can do this. And like, that is a part of this culture. You know, we all know that. He's just a very earnest, you know, kind of earnest, sincere guy in a very odd world. You know, like, he's a well-known artist in downtown LA. You know, as he said in the story, like, many of his friends have become watch collectors, or, you know, the inverse of that. You know, many people he is now considered friends or watch collectors. And just a fascinating guy that, you know, lives in a very interesting world. I mean, I don't know anybody else like him, I can say.
Yeah. Was there anything that surprised you the most as you were putting this together? Like, something that you just came totally out of left field, whether it was a watch or his sort of take on a situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like, it's not that surprising, because I know we all have these people, but like, it's surprising when it comes from somebody like Wes. And so, like, Wes is tattooed, fucking cool looking guy, you know, like, has his shit figured out, like, actual friends with Kanye West and Jay-Z and people like that. And then, you know, I reported it in the story, but he's just like, you know, like, a lot of his inspiration and the reason why he likes, you know, a certain kind of car or a certain kind of gold Daytona is taken from one of his friend's fathers, who was a stockbroker in suburban New Jersey in the 80s. And he's just like, this guy was my hero. Like, I didn't know anything else. He was like, he drove a Jaguar and he had a Bang and all stereo and like was always well, kind of stern. And like the fact that this person, and I'd love to get his name and, you know, kind of reach out to that person. The fact that this person played such an important role in kind of crafting who Wes is today, even as this guy who kind of lives in counterculture in like the real art world, is just fascinating to me. And in many ways, you know, kind of like, you know, kind of validated my own views on people like that from my own life. You know, I have people when I was very young and even today that like have really helped shape who, you know, objectively successful, you know, kind of has similar feelings about these childhood people. And again, we're not talking like, you know, Jay-Z or celebrities or, you know, Don Mattingly, maybe in my case, you know, we're talking about like your friend's father. And I think that was really like, again, it was validating because like that is who, you know, not specifically my friend's father for me, but like, that's the kind of person that I look to really inspire me and kind of who crafted me into who I am, you know?
Yeah. I think that's really fascinating, and I think the way that he plays with that, both in his art and it seems like in his life and then in his watch collecting, is like weirdly consistent. Like he really, like you said, has this sort of consistency to everything. Like, you know, he got his first watch when he was a kid. He found it. It was like a story about him having something cool that like nobody else kind of got. And then that expanded, and this juxtaposition of like high culture, low culture, pop culture, you know, super kind of rarefied air, and then more sort of like humble things or like kind of rough around the edges things is a really tough thing to do in a way that doesn't feel contrived, but he somehow manages it.
Yeah, he does. And I think I mentioned it a little bit in the story. I wanted to go longer, but somebody wouldn't let me. I forget who that was.
I wonder who that was.
Exactly. No, I think I mentioned the story, but if you look at like, there are two kind of like, you know, categories of his art. And some of them are very, you know, very morose and skeletons and very kind of like Native American Grateful Dead-y type of thing, which is, as you said, kind of like who he was as a child. And there was like a little bit of sadness and like, you know, he was definitely different in school. Like after many and like, you know, you'll see, you know, like American pickup trucks and Robert Redford and like these beautiful like Americana themed, you know, pieces that really feel pop like and like that's kind of who he is now, and that he's like he's become kind of at peace with who he is, at peace with the world around him. He's in a very loving relationship with, you know, with a woman, and like he's just, these are the two different versions of Wes. And I think, you know, I can certainly relate to that. I'm sure many of us can, but like the idea that he's able to express that so concisely into like, okay, like this version of my art represents who I was, and then this version of my art represents who I am, I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think one of the funny things here that we haven't mentioned that comes up in the story is the fact that you guys have sort of a shared connection through where he's from, right? Through Chatham, New Jersey.
Yeah. So he was born and raised in Chatham, New Jersey. I was not, but my father was, my uncles were. I spent every Christmas there, every 4th of July. I mean, it was, you know, I'm from Rochester, but, you know, after Rochester, I would say it was my second home. And, you know, I know that town really well, and it reminds me a lot of the town that I grew up in. It's just like a upper middle class, you know, town, suburban New Jersey. And it's just like, you know, knowing that town, the first time I found out about that, I was just like, how on earth did Wes Lang come from Chatham, New Jersey? And it's just like, you just have to remember that, like, you know, kind of pain and like emotional distance can exist anywhere, even in the kind of like the toniest of locations and kind of like the more privileged locations. And to be clear, you know, his father was not a stockbroker. Like they owned a record shop, you know, you know, they were more kind of middle of the road for Chatham or really anywhere. But it's just amazing to see that somebody like that came out of a place that I knew so intimately.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know we're getting close to the end here, but I wonder what you think, you know, folks listening to this and folks who read the article, which they definitely should. You should go pick up a copy of Volume 6 and check the article out. We'll link that up in the show notes. But, you know, what do you think people listening to this can learn from Wes as watch collectors or as people? Like, what do you think the takeaway here can be for folks?
I think it's manyfold, to be honest with you. I mean, I really believe Wes is one of the more interesting people I've met as a person in many years, in just that, like, he's completely comfortable with the duality of his existence. You know, as I said, there's the person that we were as a child, which, you know, in many cases be conflicted, or maybe many cases could be super happy and positive. And then there's who you are now. And I think, you know, the version of the version of myself now is dramatically different than the version of who I was when I was a teenager or an adolescent. And he really embraces that. Whereas I think a lot of people, you know, kind of run away from their past. And I think that's a really interesting side of how Wes kind of lives his life. And then as a watch collector, I mean, I think it's just, it validates that there are still interesting watch collectors out there below the age of 50. You know, and I think that's something that I've kind of like railed against often on this show, is that, like, I'm just so, like, you know, I have a 5711. I think it's great. I don't need to see any more fucking 5711s on anybody. I just don't care. You know, I'm not going to sell mine. I'm going to wear it and keep it forever. But, like, it doesn't validate you as a watch collector to wear 5711 or a 66.3 or any of this stuff. It's like, do your own thing. You know, like, do something that is interesting. And it doesn't have to be a major brand. It could be an Acrivia if you can afford it. It could be a Kodoki. It could be anything that just makes you interesting. But I mean, I think Wes has a greater appreciation for the handmade small batch stuff because that's who he is, right? I mean, like, that's effectively what he's doing. You know, he's a one man artist. Until recently, as I say, he didn't even have a manager or a gallery. Like, he was doing this all on his own. And I would say I would really encourage people to follow his lead and say, yeah, like, you know, you want to embrace the Daytona and the whatever 5970, like, great. They are as popular as they are for a reason, and I will always love them. But don't forget what else is out there, and you realize that there can be a separate kind of joy in owning something that nobody understands except for you or a very certain kind of person. So I think those would be two takeaways for sure.
That's great. I think that's a good thing to leave people with. That's awesome. And like we said, we'll link it up, but people should definitely go read the article. Despite the fact that I would not let you run any longer on word count, I really enjoyed editing this and reading this. It was a super fun one to be a part of putting together.
But it's my pleasure, as always.
Awesome. Thanks, Ben. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch up later.
Sounds good. See you guys.
Thanks, Ben. This week's episode was recorded remotely by our group of editors and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference for us. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.